Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Jeff Thomas, the Senior Vice President and Head of U.S. Western Listings and Capital Markets for NASDAQ. Previously, Jeff served as President of Liquidity Solutions at NASDAQ Private Market, where he worked closely with private companies to help them provide shareholder liquidity prior to IPO. Prior to joining NASDAQ in 2014, Jeff held senior positions at Second Market, Gerson Lerman Group, and Altera. He now also sits on the board of directors of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. In this podcast, we talk about the current market conditions, including IPOs, SPACs, M&As, direct listings, venture capital, and crypto. We also talk about the growth of private markets, including the story and spin-off of the NASDAQ Private Market. Finally, we discuss the NASDAQ new boardroom diversity rule, ESG, and other matters relevant to corporate governance and board of directors. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Jeff, it is so good to have you in the Boardroom Governance Podcast. It's been a while since we talked, but what a market. I'm very excited to talk to you about what's going on with NASDAQ and what's going on with other governance initiatives. So first of all, how's everything going with you?
You know, 2021 has been an unprecedented year. We're setting records across all aspects of the capital markets this year. If you go back to, you know, Q1 of 2020, when the pandemic hit, you know, at that point, we didn't think we'd see another IPO for the rest of 2020. Obviously, then people started doing virtual roadshows in June that year, and we had a record-setting year last year, and now it has just continued this year. So it is an absolutely wild time here at NASDAQ.
So I obviously want to dig into these numbers, into your perspectives, but before we do that, why don't you tell us more about you? Where did you grow up? And we'll move from there all the way to NASDAQ.
Sounds good. So yeah, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. As I was looking at where I wanted to go to school, I had two really important criteria. The first was I wanted to get into engineering. And the second was I wanted to play football.
Okay.
And I wasn't very good at football, but I was pretty good at engineering. So the right answer for me was Carnegie Mellon, a Division III school. So obviously not the top tier football program, but a great engineering program. Mm-hmm. And so graduated in 2000 with a degree in electrical and computer engineering, and pretty quickly made my way out to Silicon Valley. And my first job was actually in semiconductors. So I worked at Altera for about 6 years. About 2 weeks into my professional career, I figured out I wanted to get into sales and business development. Mm-hmm. And then about 5 years after that, I decided that it might be more interesting to do sales and business development in something other than semiconductors. And so that's when I got into financial services. Mm-hmm. I worked at a couple of really interesting private companies in financial services, Gerson Lerman Group, an expert network where I got to know a lot of the private equity and venture capital community. Mm-hmm. Second Market, where we were making markets in pre-IPO stocks, which is still a fascinating space today. And then third was an early stage startup called Owler, which was crowdsourcing data on private companies. So all really interesting, fun jobs. And that's what really led me then to NASDAQ, who back in 2014 was looking to launch a competitor to Second Market. Mm-hmm. So I joined to help launch NASDAQ Private Market. The next year, we actually ended up acquiring Second Market. So that was a bit of a homecoming. And then in 2016, I got promoted to run the listings team for NASDAQ on the West Coast.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot there. You know, one area that I definitely want to talk to you about is the growth of private markets, even though you are running the public side of things, but you have a lot of experience. You were there in the early days with Second Market. There's been a lot of development. And why don't we start first with NASDAQ? And you described a little bit your role, but tell us more about what you're doing now and kind of your vision towards NASDAQ and what's next.
The journey that we've been on at NASDAQ here over the last 5 or 6 years has been to create really a lifecycle approach to supporting our corporate clients. So that starts at the earliest stages with the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center, which is a 501c3 that donates free education and resources to early stage founders. And we have some fantastic partners on that. Then as companies grow and scale, we've got NASDAQ Private Market, which helps companies provide liquidity to their shareholders. I mentioned the listings business. So we compete with the New York Stock Exchange for every IPO in the US and have been doing so successfully over the past few years. And then once companies are public, we offer a number of products and services to help empower their investor relations, corporate governance, and ESG disclosure practices. And so that business is actually achieving a pretty large scale, getting close to the size of the listings business at NASDAQ, which is obviously what we're known for. Mm-hmm. And of course, outside of all of this work that we do with our corporate clients, we of course operate exchanges here in the US as well as in Europe. We have an investment intelligence business where we run indexes like the NASDAQ 100. We sell market data. We sell alternative data. And then one of the really interesting things we've been working on lately is being a technology provider into the capital markets. So selling our core exchange technology to over 100 other markets around the globe. We have a best-in-class market surveillance technology that helps companies, helps broker-dealers and regulators around the globe weed out bad actors. And just last year, we expanded that portfolio with the acquisition of Verafin. So we're now a major player in the anti-financial crime space, supporting the banking ecosystem with things like anti-money laundering and know your customer solutions.
Yeah, I did notice that and took note. Why don't we start with the incredible time in markets, right? You mentioned IPOs, 560 IPOs through the first three quarters of this year. That's raising $136 billion just on NASDAQ. There have been about 104 tech companies that have raised $63 billion all in all. This includes the growth on SPACs, right? Which there's been 463 IPOs that have raised $130 billion. So that's incredible numbers. M&A, by the way, is at all-time record, $6 trillion potentially by the end of the year per KPMG. And we've also seen direct listings rise as a new vehicle for going public. And NASDAQ is also offering this. You know, why don't we start with the IPOs and tell us more about what you're seeing and growth of these new publicly listed offerings?
Yeah. So as a private company, you've never had more options and better access to capital and liquidity. So the only stats you didn't cover there was the growth in private company funding, which I think Q3, there was more venture capital raised than all of 1999 and 2000 put together.
Yeah.
Which is just a phenomenal stat because that was kind of the peak of the last big dot-com boom. So if you're a private company looking to raise capital, you can obviously go raise a late stage venture round. There's about $100 million round, seems like every day announced in the press. If you're looking to go public and raise capital, then you've got two primary options. There's the traditional IPO. We've had over 250 operating companies go public on NASDAQ this year. And so it's a great time for that. Valuations are very rich right now. Volatility has been relatively low. So the ability to go out and price a deal has been very attractive. And then the second opportunity, if you want to raise capital, that companies you're looking at is, of course, SPACs, which you mentioned. So there's been an enormous number of special purpose acquisition companies that have raised capital, and they have 2 years to deploy that capital to acquire an operating company and bring them to the public markets. So we can go through all the trade-offs between those two. And then, of course, the third option, which you mentioned, is a direct listing. And so that for the companies that have chose that path this year has been primarily about providing liquidity to their shareholders. There is a rule in place by the SEC, approved by the SEC, that allows companies to raise capital through a direct listing, although the current rule that's been approved isn't very attractive to companies. We can go through the details on that. So you have a lot of choice, a lot of options. And as I mentioned, it's been a great time for companies that are looking to raise capital in the public markets.
Right. And all of this, obviously, in the backdrop of a pandemic where interest rates are super low, so people are looking for liquidity. And the contrast is pretty intense, right? You have maybe the country suffering from this pandemic, but capital markets and deal makings and IPOs are at all-time records. It's interesting that times are so good, and it may be a notion of what's going on with also the government and programs to support the economy. There's been a lot of money pumped from the US government and low inflation rate. So any thoughts and feedback on the economy and the impact for public offerings?
Well, I think anytime you have one of these black swan events, like a global pandemic, that creates an enormous disruption in the way things are done. It makes things incredibly challenging for many people, but it also creates opportunities. And one of the things that we've seen happen through the global pandemic is the acceleration of digital transformation. As everybody had to really quickly figure out how to work from home, how to conduct business remotely without coming together in offices and do things digitally, I think it created this enormous acceleration in the adoption of enterprise technology. And I think that's really what's driven a lot of the intensity around the funding of both private companies, as well as the appetite for investors for IPOs, is companies that are driving that digital adoption and acceleration. I think the other thing I'd highlight is obviously what you mentioned, which is the fiscal and the monetary stimulus that the US government has put in place to support the economy. Anytime you pump that much liquidity into the system, those dollars obviously have to flow somewhere. Of course, one of the things we really watch closely here at NASDAQ is the interest rate environment. And so the fact that the 10-year note has hovered between 1.2 and 1.6%, that obviously creates, as you mentioned, investors looking for yield in other places. And it also creates a higher valuation for those future cash flows for technology companies, many of whom have gone public on NASDAQ.
So obviously the whole capital markets has benefited from this environment. We've talked about the public markets. Private markets, potentially even more of growth, right? You mentioned earlier in the podcast in the NASDAQ private market, but earlier this year, there was a spinoff from your business. Why don't you tell us about that spinoff and the new joint venture that you have, and why was the spinoff done? And the growth of the NASDAQ private market, I think you've raised about $31 billion, or at least there were $31 billion in transactions or liquidity transactions done. So it is a big component of what's going on with secondary transactions, but tell us more about that.
So I've been involved in the private secondary market since 2010 when I joined Second Market. Right. So at the time, it was very much an over-the-counter market where we were out there finding shareholders, matching them up with a potential buyer, submitting in a transfer request to the company. Many companies would have a right of first refusal, so oftentimes those transactions wouldn't even consummate. And so it was a very manual process. One of the things we started developing at Second Market and continued the development here at NASDAQ was the ability for companies to run large-scale liquidity programs, many of which were structured as a tender offer, where the company would line up one or a handful of investors who would offer to buy securities from their existing shareholders. And those programs were often used to attract and retain talent by allowing employees to sell a portion of their vested equity or to clean up the cap table by bringing in late stage investors and then providing liquidity to early stage investors. Over the past few years, we've seen an acceleration of some interesting market dynamics there as well. So we've started to see more companies that want to bring in a new price setting mechanism by using some of our auction technology to help set the price for the secondary transactions. And so we've worked especially with companies that are pursuing direct listings to create ongoing markets ahead of those direct listings. So that's been an interesting new use case. Mm-hmm. And then also just a wider acceptance of companies of wanting to provide liquidity on more of a regular basis. It wasn't that long ago where companies would kind of think about doing maybe one liquidity program or two before they go public. Now we have companies that are doing this regularly every year. Some are talking about extending that to quarterly, so creating more ongoing markets in their shares. So I think the markets have really become far more robust. You mentioned we've done over $31 billion in transactions. That's across over 500 different issuers. And so it's really expanded the pool and the size of the market. And so I think to capitalize on some of those trends that we were seeing, we brought in some really interesting strategic investors, specifically Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, and Silicon Valley Bank. And so we brought them in as investors to a new joint venture. And so that's what led to the spin out of the NASDAQ private market business, mm-hmm. so that we could have the scale and the reach of some of those fantastic institutions to help power the next generation of growth here.
So that takes us to a question that in Silicon Valley, people talked about for a long time, which is staying private for longer, right? There was a conventional wisdom that, you know, in this market, companies could stay private forever. There was so much capital, not only from venture capital, but private equity and different hedge funds and sovereign wealth funds and mutual funds. But after in the pandemic, we realized that the public markets opened up. And as you mentioned earlier, 250 operating companies going public only in 2021. So do you think that this idea of staying private for longer or forever is dead? Or where do you see that spectrum in terms of evolution, whether a company is staying private or going public?
Well, I always think you have to boil it down to what's the company's goals and objectives at different phases of their life cycle. So companies go public for a variety of reasons, but some of the primary ones are to raise capital, to provide liquidity, to get the brand enhancement of being a publicly listed company, and then to be able to leverage their equity as an acquisition currency. And so as you kind of go through each of those different goals, as we've talked about, there's plenty of capital available to private companies. So while you may want to go public because the valuations are attractive, there is an alternative there. The liquidity that you can generate as a private company is still just really a subset of what you can do as a public company. And as a public company, your mm-hmm. stock trades, you know, every second of every day. As a private company, these are still discrete events. And so it's just a different scale in terms of the liquidity you want to provide. I think that branding and prestige is something, especially for companies that are in a B2B type of environment. Having your financials out there publicly, qualifying to list on a national stock exchange, I do think that that has material benefits to you, especially when you're selling to other businesses. I also think there's a lift in terms of that for consumer-facing brands. I think it just brings you a little bit more into the public consciousness. And then as you think about inorganic growth and looking, if you want to go out and grow through acquisitions, it's much easier to price an acquisition with your equity if you're publicly listed than if you are privately funded, because there's no, you know, mm-hmm. current market for your shares. So I think you just kind of look at what are the company's goals, what are they trying to do? And that's what's going to inform their strategy on, do they want to raise capital privately, publicly? Do they want to look at a SPAC or direct mm-hmm. listing?
So in the private market space, in this staying private for longer, you know, we've seen the growth and evolution of these unicorns, right? And people talk about there's already 863 unicorns globally. Valuation market cap is about 2.8 trillion per CB Insight. So it's a very big asset class. Some regulators are starting to get nervous. Last week, there was a commissioner of the SEC who talked about these going dark, where private markets are less intense in terms of regulation, in terms of obligations, in terms of corporate governance. Do you think there's going to be some sort of new regulatory framework in place? Because this is a new type of company, right? Like companies that are worth billions of dollars with hundreds or thousands of employees operating in tens or hundreds of countries. I mean, it is a different world in which we live in.
Well, so the core of what the SEC does, they have a dual mandate to protect investors and facilitate capital formation. Mm-hmm. And one of the hallmarks of the Exchange Act and what the SEC does is the concept that if there's going to be retail investors in a security, then those securities should be registered and there should be public disclosures about those companies. If a company is only going to raise capital from what's known as an accredited investor, then the SEC has not seen that that those investors are really fit within their purview, mm-hmm. right? So if you're an accredited investor, the concept is that you have the means and the resources to stomach greater risk and to do greater due diligence. And so when you look at all of these unicorns that are out there, you know, the vast majority of them, again, are raising capital from accredited investors, qualified institutional buyers, which again, historically has fallen outside of the purview of some of these regulations that we're talking about. So what does that mean for everyday investors? It means that as these companies are staying private longer, they're being kept out of the growth that you can see through some of these late stage private companies, and they're not able to participate until later in their life cycle. And so I think under the previous administration, the commission was looking at how do you provide greater access to that growth stage company to Main Street investors. And I think, you know, NASDAQ, we're very supportive of that line of thinking because we think it does contribute to the wealth gap in America. Mm-hmm. If you have a regime where only the wealthiest people can invest in the highest growth opportunities, that obviously disadvantages, everyday Americans. But if you kind of look at the second mandate of the SEC, it's to facilitate capital formation. So if they did something that would make it harder for companies to raise capital, that could stifle innovation and economic growth. I think it's interesting, if you go back to 2012, that's when the Jobs Act passed.
Right.
And there were some great innovations in the Jobs Act that really did lead to more public offerings, specifically the ability for companies to file their registration documents with the SEC confidentially until they were ready to really launch their roadshow. But the other thing they did that the Jobs Act did was to raise the limit on the number of shareholders. And so it used to be back in 2011 and prior, if you had over 500 shareholders, including employees, at the end of the year, you had to go public within, I think it was either 3 or 6 months. And now private companies can have up to 2,000 shareholders, excluding employees. And so they have far more room on their cap table for new investors. And that's one of the reasons you have seen that continued extension of staying private longer.
Yeah, no, those are really good remarks because that those are actually things that have changed the market, and the Jobs Act was important in that respect. Interestingly, one side that I think is still very small but growing rapidly, you talked about retail capitalism or retail investors, and there is a new crowdfunding rule that allows unaccredited investors to invest up to $5 million per a company. And so that may start getting new retail investors into new companies. I think it's still small compared to obviously the public markets and obviously the private investing by accredited investors. And we saw earlier this year, retail investors investing in companies in a much different way, right? The narrative in corporate governance has been historically that institutional investors are getting more and more in the agenda of corporate governance, the BlackRock's, Fidelity, State Street of the world. And the retail investors were kind of an afterthought. But now with these meme stocks, right, and these smaller investors, there's been kind of a rebirth of this retailers. Any thought on that angle? And obviously, you come in from NASDAQ, so you've seen some of this happen. But it also may impact in other ways where ownership may be more distributed in different ways.
Yeah, I think the rise of retail investing has been driven by a couple factors. One, I don't think when Robinhood started, anybody assumed that we would see zero commissions come into vogue as quickly as they did. And so it really did change that landscape of retail investing. And so I think that has continued to drive down the cost of trading for everyday Americans to make the financial markets more accessible to everyday Americans. And I think it really put a lot of pressure on some of the existing incumbents in that space. And then I think the other thing you've seen through some of the meme stocks, obviously, is the advent of the impact of social media. If you go back to the late 90s and the dot-com boom, right? That was all happening on Yahoo message boards, which seem pretty antiquated now, versus, today's, ways of communication like Reddit that are out there that just allow people to communicate much more quickly and efficiently. And so I think really the questions for the SEC to consider on these topics is, what controls need to be put in place to make sure that retail investors continue to be well-informed? How should they think about market manipulation when it comes to some of these social media platforms and the opportunity for bad actors to manipulate the prices of these securities. But overall, I think the fact that you have more people participating in the financial markets, taking an interest in the financial markets, and just actively trading, I think is a good thing, because what we have seen over the you know past few decades, right, is the more people participate in the markets, that again is going to help to close the wealth gap and get more people engaged in the system. So I think that's, you know, something we're very bullish on here at NASDAQ.
So, you know, that's really interesting. And it just reminds me, yesterday, the SEC just published a report on this exact phenomenon of meme stocks and others. But one area that has had tremendous growth and importance in corporate governance has been ESG. You mentioned that NASDAQ has been involved in this kind of movement. How do you perceive the growth of this environmental social governance movement in companies and in the stock market? And how has that changed the framework for boards and for executives in companies listed on NASDAQ?
Well, so I think it all starts with the generational shift that's going on. So as the largest wealth transfer we've ever seen from the baby boomer generation to the millennial generation happens, you see that this next generation of investors has a very strong interest in things outside of just the bottom line, right? How are companies thinking about their corporate social responsibility strategy? And then I think there's also this growing recognition that the risks presented to companies are not just things that happen within their four walls. And so there are lots of issues that happen through the environment, through the changes we're seeing as a society that need to be reflected and addressed by their corporate governance. And so as you kind of see investors and really stakeholders of all kinds in these companies looking for greater disclosure on these issues, there's been this explosion of different rating frameworks, rankers, and other folks that are out there trying to gather data on these non-financial metrics for especially public companies. And so that's led to some really interesting challenges for companies, but also some opportunities. So the challenges are now you have a lot of folks gathering data on you, and it's not always clear the process that they're using to gather that data. You have a lot of, especially your investors, looking at different ratings and rankings versus just your financial statements. And so you really need to be thoughtful about the different frameworks that are out there, the information that you're publishing and how that's being consumed. Because I think the opportunity is there's an enormous amount of capital out there that at least is being marketed as ESG focused funds. And so those funds will be looking at these ratings and these rankings to try to figure out which companies they want to go invest in. But I think that's something else the SEC has been very clear about recently. They want to make sure that those fund managers are truly, you know, walking the walk and not just talking the talk.
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be one area that we'll see the commission continue to focus on as well.
Yeah. In fact, there is an investigation with Deutsche Bank, I think, that were claiming to have some sort of investments, ESG or sustainability funds, and people are looking into all these different proclamations and greenwashing and so forth. If you think of ESG, right, it really is the growth of the E and the S. On the S side, interestingly, social matters, diversity has changed a lot on boards. And California was kind of the first state to establish specific gender requirements on boards of public companies. They have a new law called SB 826 2 years ago, 2018, that said that in boards, depending on the size, you would have to add some gender, other woman on boards. And then last year, we had AB 979 in California, which uses the same framework, but for minorities. And so it's really interesting to see this evolution. Different states are doing different things, but NASDAQ also has proposed a new diversity rule that uses the same gender and minority framework to say, look, if you're a publicly traded company in NASDAQ, you will need to have some level of gender and minority inclusion And tell us more about this new role and where you're at this time and what kind of prompted this evolution.
You bet. So one thing we did see was, a number of different state and local frameworks attempting to address this issue. And we saw nothing really being done at the national level. So we thought that there was an opportunity for us as an SRO, a self-regulatory organization that is mandated with overseeing the corporate governance of our listed companies, to really think about how we could be additive on this topic. One thing that's been very lacking is any kind of standard disclosure standards on mm-hmm. this topic. So you have a lot of companies who are trying to figure out how to disclose the diversity of their board. You have different groups that are asking for the information in different ways. So one of the things our rule filing did was define a consistent disclosure matrix. So that matrix really has two core principles. One, the concept of self-identification. So letting every board member identify their gender, race, and sexual orientation. And then two, the concept of personal privacy. So disclosing the information on an aggregated basis rather than an individually identifiable basis. So that's really the first and I think most important aspect of the rule filing was to have this standard disclosure matrix across all NASDAQ listed companies so that investors and academics and other stakeholders could really measure the diversity of these boards. The second thing we did was propose some minimum standards. So the concept that you should have at least some minimum level of diversity on your board. But we also wanted to make sure that the framework and the rule was flexible enough to accommodate for issuers who just had different sets of facts and circumstances. So we also gave companies the ability to explain mm-hmm. if they didn't have some minimum level of diversity on their board, why that was the right choice for them at the time. And then the third thing that we heard strongly from the business community was whatever changes you'd like to see on a board, it always takes longer than you think, just because boards are fairly slow moving organizations, where to find a new board member takes time, it takes resources, and obviously you have to decide if you're going to replace a board member or add a board member. And so for those minimum diversity standards, we did allow some fairly generous phase-in timelines. And so then, we filed this rule in December, went through the public comment period. We got over 200 comment letters. About 80% were positive of the 20% that were negative. 10% said we shouldn't be doing this, and 10% said we didn't go far enough. Mm-hmm. That rule was approved in August by the SEC. And so public companies on NASDAQ will now be required to include the board diversity matrix in their proxy statement in 2022, and then start having at least one diverse board member starting in 2023, and then a second diverse board member in either 2025 or 2026, depending on the market tier they're listed on.
All right. Now that's really good, and it's good to know. Let's finish up with one area that may not be completely applicable to NASDAQ, but maybe you do have some connection, which is crypto and blockchain. I remember early in the evolution of blockchain technology and Bitcoin, there was talk about exchanges using blockchain to maybe do some of the voting. But in the meantime, cryptocurrencies are already reaching $2.5 trillion in value. Bitcoin is by itself a $1 trillion asset class now, and it's at all-time, I think, records, maybe 62,000 or something like that. How do you see Bitcoin or crypto in general? And one of the, I suppose, challenges to NASDAQ is they offer decentralized opportunities to trade, and there are decentralized exchanges like Uniswap and MetaMask and others that are doing different things. But maybe any thought on crypto and how does NASDAQ think about blockchain technology?
Well, we were obviously thrilled to welcome Coinbase to the NASDAQ family. Right. When they went public this year through their direct listing on NASDAQ, the largest ever direct listing. And I think that was really seen as kind of a coming out party for crypto, bringing it into the mainstream. This week, we're going to see the first listed Bitcoin ETF based mm-hmm. on futures contracts. We see other players out there looking to do listed ETFs on actually physical holdings of Bitcoin. So it's really an interesting and dynamic time for the cryptocurrency market. Obviously, Bitcoin is the largest, but there's many other forms of cryptocurrency out there. And you know, as you mentioned, the trading of cryptocurrency is across a large number of platforms. And so one of the things that we've been doing here at NASDAQ is we, as I mentioned, sell our technology to other exchanges, including crypto exchanges. And then really that surveillance technology that I talked about, that ability to understand bad actors and market manipulation that's going on. We've seen a strong demand from a number of the platforms for that technology as well. You've obviously seen the SEC as well as the CFTC looking at the regulatory structure around cryptocurrencies. And I think, you know, you'll be sure to see more coming out of both the SEC and the CFTC on that front this year. So it's still, I'd say, early innings in terms of the regulatory framework, but obviously, you know, a huge explosion in the popularity. And despite what Jamie Dimon says, you know, it seems like it's going to be here to stick around to stay.
No, I must agree with that. And there's a lot of things that we're looking at, even in the governance side of things. And there's decentralized autonomous organizations and other types of, innovation. So it's really interesting. Let's switch to some rapid fire questions. What are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
Well, my favorite book of all time, it's an oldie but a goodie. It's How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. So that's something I go back to and try to, you know, reread at least every 6 months. It's amazing. It's, written, a long time ago, but all the axioms still hold true. And then the book I just got done reading is called Genius Makers, and it's about the rise of AI and neural networks at the big tech companies. And so that's another one, as you think about what's going to be disruptive to not just the financial markets, but really every aspect of our life. It's going to be the rise of artificial intelligence. And so it's a great read to kind of get a good look at the current landscape.
All right. And who are your mentors and what did you learn from them?
Well, one of my mentors here at NASDAQ was Bruce Ost, who ran our global listings team for 12 years. And then he came back out here to the West Coast right about the same time that I joined NASDAQ. And so, you know, when I, got the opportunity to spend a bunch of time with Bruce, who was out here really focused on starting up the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center, but also continuing to support our listings business as a vice chairman. He just had so much history and knowledge of, you know, not only the exchange landscape, but obviously the community out here in Silicon Valley. And so I think some of the things I learned from Bruce was kind of how to, you know, take a step back, especially around some of these big, you know, seismic shifts in the economy and help to kind of see around some corners on where some of the opportunity would be. And then also just the importance of growing and maintaining a professional network so that you can kind of, you know, stay ahead of the curve on all these quickly changing topics.
Yeah. And you just made me think as well a little bit on the technology side for boardrooms themselves. I mean, you did acquire Boardvantage and you have a board portal from NASDAQ. You know, how do you see the evolution of technology within the boardroom and how does NASDAQ operate within that framework?
Well, if you look at, best practices for boards, obviously, you know, security is one of the key topics, right? The board is dealing with the most sensitive information that the company has. So having a secure board portal like NASDAQ Boardvantage to secure your board books and really all the communications between your board is absolutely critical. But then when you think about the functioning of your board, we did another acquisition of a group called Center for Board Excellence that helps with board evaluations as well as director and officer questionnaires to really make sure your board is performing at a very high level is really critical, especially to get that third party perspective sometimes. And then lastly, of course, the topic of ESG is just, very relevant today for today's board. So we've gone around and educated over 100 boards on kind of the ESG landscape. We have an advisory team that dozens of companies have hired to go out and help them identify their strategy around ESG disclosure. And then another acquisition we did last year was NASDAQ One report, which actually helps companies gather and report those ESG metrics in a process that gives the company some good controls and governance around that topic. So that's another critical aspect of the boardroom discussion.
No, that's great. All very important evolutions. All right. So what is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Well, I guess it takes me back to one other book that was really influential in my life. I read the book Extreme Ownership, which was written by a couple of Navy SEALs, and it applies their learnings from the battlefield to business world. And one of the things that really stuck out that I now do every single day, they say, first thing you do when you wake up in the morning is to make your bed. Mm. And it's kind of this strange thing where you wouldn't think that that would be life-changing, but the theory is that then every day you are starting out by accomplishing something. And if you think about your days as, you know, just this series of opportunities to accomplish different tasks, getting out and starting that as soon as you wake up, I think is a really good habit to build into your daily life.
Yeah, I think that's great. It doesn't seem absurd to me. Is that Jocko Willing, the authors?
Yeah.
No, they have all these good lessons out there. Jeff, thank you so much for talking to me about what's going on in the markets, what's going on with NASDAQ and the private markets. I know there's a lot of different elements and certainly also the governance aspect of this. I'll see you soon. In fact, I know I'll see you soon. We're going to do a program together with UCLA and UC Hastings. So thank you again. And where can people find you online so that they can learn more about NASDAQ or other elements that you want them to know?
Well, I try to keep a lot of relevant posts going out on LinkedIn. That's kind of my social network of choice for NASDAQ related things. So follow me there. And then, of course, if you have any interest in going public or learning more about NASDAQ, my team and I'd be happy to get in touch.
All right. Thank you again, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.